Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
All right, welcome back to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. Tim, good to see you again.
Mike, happy Friday. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy Friday. Today, we have a guest, our colleague Kellyanne Shaw, who is a partner in our International Trade and Government Relations Group at Hogan Lovells. I'll let Kellyanne give a little bit more of her background, but just some brief highlights here. Kellyanne previously served as a counsel in the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. She's served on the National Security Council and the National Economic Council in the White House. She's played a very large role in a wide range of legislation and negotiations and agreements in the international trade space. We've invited her on the show today as an expert in international economic policy and development and trade to talk about critical minerals. So Kellyanne, thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Happy Friday to both of you. It's always a pleasure. You know, as you said, I've been a partner at Hogan Lovells for the past 3 years. I mostly help companies who want to grow, innovate, and build out resilient and successful supply chains here in the United States, and of course, with many of our trading partners across industrials, technologies, renewable sectors, and some others. So it's been a lot of fun after transitioning from 10 years in government, where I was a U.S. trade negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative for 6 years, three of those in Geneva, Switzerland, and three of those back in D.C. I also worked for the Ways and Means Committee as a trade and investment advisor to the chairman. And then most recently, I came from the White House, where I led an office at the White House called INTICON, which is dual-hatted to both the National Security Council and the National Economic Council, responsible for all global economic policy, including energy, environment, trade, investment, and then the G20, G7, APEC, and other multilateral dialogue. So I've had a ton of experience, and what knits them all together is actually a conversation on critical minerals and rare earths, as this is a problem the U.S. has been facing for quite some time. So really excited about the topic today.
Thanks so much for joining us, Kellyanne. And probably, you know, the question at the outset for our listeners is, you know, what are critical minerals and rare earths? You know, we're hearing about them in the news a lot, and my guess is that most people really don't understand what they are.
Yeah, well, you know, for good reason in some respects, because critical minerals, the definition of them changes based on your geography, your government, your geology. You know, effectively what they are metallic and non-metallic elements with two main characteristics. One being they're really important for the modern economy, for technology or military applications, national security applications. And two, there is a significant risk of supply chain disruption. So you can imagine years and years ago, even table salt could have been considered a critical mineral. But today, at least from the U.S. perspective, there are 35 of them that the U.S. government identifies and is actively trying to come up with proactive policy with respect to.
And why are they critical? What makes them as opposed to, you know, other substances that we use, you know, in the supply chain to make stuff? What makes these 35 elements so important?
Yeah, it's that risk of supply chain disruption that really goes into the criticality of these minerals. But, you know, looking at the modern economy now, you know, everyone's got a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop. When you're holding your smartphone, you're holding literally 50% of the entire periodic table, from the display to the speakers to the battery that goes into it, the electronics. And these minerals come from different places on Earth. Now, the critical mineral policy really does intersect when it comes to national security, because a lot of the minerals are controlled by China, not just in terms of where they're geologically located, but in terms of the supply chain and the processing of it as well. So you'll hear a lot of discussions in the context of U.S.-China relations. You'll hear discussions of critical minerals when it comes to things like environmental policy, clean energy, electric vehicles, and then, of course, in high technology, military applications, and other types of more modern economic commerce that's happening, because critical minerals are so important to all of those products.
So Kellyanne, I've been hearing that our need for these critical minerals just in the EV electric vehicle space over about the next 10 to 15 years is going to be about four times what it is now. And if that's the case, and if so much of this is controlled either within China or, you know, in areas geographically proximate to China, what is the United States doing and thinking about doing in order to close that vulnerability gap, so to speak, as well as just get more of this stuff out of the ground?
Yeah, no, it is really interesting, particularly in the EV battery space. So you think about an EV battery, and the main components are the cathode, the anode, the electrolytes in between. The cathode piece of it, for most EV batteries today, are comprised of three main elements. So you have they're called MMC batteries. So it's the nickel, the manganese, and the cobalt. Now, a lot of the nickel actually comes from Russia. So you can imagine some of the geopolitical tensions that are happening right now over the war in Ukraine and wanting to diversify some of that supply chain. And cobalt, 70% of the global supply of cobalt right now comes from the DRC, where there's a whole bunch of other issues we can talk about related to that as well. So
that's Congo, by the way. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
Yeah, so we got to be careful with our acronym speak for our listeners. There's a lot of fun acronyms. We'll spell it out for everybody.
The Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah.
and there are alternative EV battery technologies related to LFP batteries. So that's comprised of lithium, iron, and phosphate. Now, there are some differences between these two types of battery technologies. NMC technologies lead to longer charge times. They're viewed as superior technology in terms of the car's overall performance, but LFP batteries are slowly catching up and they are gaining some market ground. So, you know, a few things are happening around this. One, the Department of Energy released a blueprint, I think it was either last year or at the end of 2021, saying that one of the goals of the administration is to try to make batteries that are free from cobalt and nickel. So it's that transition to alternative types of battery supply. You also have efforts to come up with domestic sources for a lot of the battery materials as well. And that's taking all shapes and sizes, from private industry who is trying to invest and come up with alternative sourcing, to the government who is incentivizing as well as penalizing. You have the Inflation Reduction Act, which had specific percentage thresholds for critical minerals and requires that they're sourced from an FTA country. So there are a bunch of different lines of efforts and policies aimed at trying to onshore, nearshore, friendshore, allied shore these critical minerals for important EV battery technology and make sure that the U.S. is not overly dependent on China, so that China can't just, you know, say, we're not going to export these materials to you anymore. And then we're sort of left holding the bag with a lot of demand and some pretty ambitious climate policy and energy goals.
Yeah, you mentioned allied and friendshoring. So that's something I wanted to ask about as well, is are there particular allied countries where the U.S. has said, you know, either formally or maybe informally, you or one or two or three of you are our preferred source for a certain given mineral instead of China? Or is it kind of more up in the air in terms of, well, we're exploring what allies can provide, but it's kind of like looking for the domestic sources here, which is who's got it? Let's have a conversation and then we'll work on our supply chains.
Yeah, there are a lot of complicating factors involved in that question. So yes, the U.S. is in active talks with allies, friends, and other nations to see where alternative sources and supply chains exist. One example is the Mineral Strategic Partnership, which is led by the Department of State. They just announced a new initiative with both Congo and Zambia to not only mine battery minerals, but also process them as well and potentially lead to the assembly of certain EV batteries down the line. So that is a growing partnership. It's not just led by the United States. There are several allied countries involved in that effort. But part of this is just geology. So while some of these minerals are more scarce and more rare than others, a lot of them are pretty dispersed throughout the Earth's crust. But the problem isn't just having them be physically in your soil. It's, are they physically in your soil in a significant amount in which it's commercially viable to actually set up a mine and dig them out of the ground. So that's part of the challenge as well. And then there's, of course, some potential drawbacks to being involved in one aspect of the supply chain or other. There are environmental impacts, there are water impacts, there are logistical impacts, and all sorts of other questions which are being asked and still being vetted right now. But certainly this is a top priority of the administration. It was a top priority of the Trump administration as well. Even the Obama administration was pursuing many of these policies. So it's very bipartisan interest in both the U.S. administration and in Congress.
You mentioned batteries, which I had not heard about in terms of an option of like, can we develop alternatives so we don't use, for example, the nickel or the cobalt? And that's an interesting technological solution, which is, well, we recognize that we have a reliance on perhaps not a friendly source for the critical components for a given product. So let's come up with an alternative if possible. And so they're exploring that in the battery realm. Are there any other examples you could share with our listeners in terms of, well, here's another piece of technology that either industry themselves maybe has offered, or maybe the U.S. government has brought forward in terms of to reduce our reliance on some of these critical minerals, here's an alternative product, you know, or an alternative way of doing the technology? Because that's sort of a different way to take this than let's lock down the sources of supply and say, well, can we kind of get out of our reliance?
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting. And I'll qualify that I'm not a scientist. I am a lawyer and a lobbyist. But from my understanding, you know, many of these elements are relatively substitutable. And the closer they are to one another on the periodic table, the more substitutable they are. However, and this is a big however, messing with the formula, even just a little, could lead to some pretty significant safety concerns, hazard concerns. I mean, cobalt is one of the critical minerals that's gained quite a bit of attention, particularly because of its use in EV battery technology, but also because of some of the child labor, human rights abuses associated with its mining. So there are certainly efforts to try to replace cobalt, but it is one of the elements that actually prevents batteries from just exploding and blowing up and causing fires, right? So when you're looking at alternative battery sources, you have to be very careful about the chemistry and the way that you're substituting some of these elements for one another. But there are trade-offs, like copper wires, for example, could easily be substituted by aluminum wires. But then you end up in a situation in which you're compromising some performance, you have to make other adjustments. And so I do think that there are certainly ways to innovate around some of these elements, but you can't innovate around everything. And so there's certainly going to be lots and lots of efforts to try to onshore, allied shore, near shore, and try to pick out where we can do more with like-minded allies with respect to some of the most critical minerals that are needed for everyday products.
This is fascinating. So what is the United States doing to try to stimulate production domestically? And if you could also talk about what domestic actually means in the context of stimulating production domestically, because I think it may involve our neighbors to the north and south, the immediate neighbors.
Yeah, there are lots of different lines of efforts happening right now from the perspective of the U.S. government. You know, there's no silver bullet here, right? There's not one thing that can happen that's going to fix our problems. It's going to be a combination of federal policies, state level policies, local policies, as well as participation by the corporate sector, by companies themselves who want to get into this market or who want a more reliable source, and then consumers. And we should talk about that as well, because I'm talking about recycling and one of the challenges and opportunities there. But, you know, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and its provisions related to tax credits for EV batteries had some very strict guidelines and percentage thresholds about where critical minerals would come from. In the CHIPS Act, in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act that was passed earlier last year, there were a number of provisions for R&D in the critical mineral space as well. The U.S. government tends to take more of a carrot approach as opposed to a stick approach, right? We want to incentivize our private sector to innovate as opposed to a command and control approach taken by China and other economies that say, you must do this. It's just part of the American ethos. It's the part of the way we do business. And so I think we'll see more of those types of policies. Other types of policies that are currently being explored are the ideas of doing a consortium, something where we partner with other like-minded allies and create just an internal market. And you're either in the market or you're outside of the market, but we commit to trade with, say, you know, Australia and Chile, which have rich critical minerals, would be part of this effort. along with the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And, you know, assuming we within the whatever the consortium looked like had enough supply, would only commit to trading with one another and developing with one another. So those types of models are being discussed. There was some legislation from the last Congress. You know, we'll see where any of that goes. A lot of this is premature. I really do think that the transition to the green economy, emphasis on electric vehicles, battery storage, solar, all of this is driving once again an effort to tackle this critical minerals dependency that really has been plaguing the United States for the last 15 years.
Do you think that is that a race that we're going to be able to win? In other words, is, you know, supply going to be able to keep up with demand, or are we going to find ourselves sort of in a shortfall for some period of time?
Well, it certainly looks like a shortfall in a short period of time, unless we can come up with something pretty quickly. You know, I heard that there is a company in California, for example. Right now, there's only one active lithium mine in the United States, and we only produce 1% of all the lithium that we use. I think we import something like 80% from China. But there is another process that's underway in California. Instead of doing a rock extraction, it would use the salt brine method. So in a way, you're not mining, you're actually just heating this fluid. And it's the circular process to get the lithium out from the fluid in which it exists in this form in this lake in California. So that's another sort of aspect of innovation in terms of trying to create more supply here. But, you know, I also think that you're going to see more efforts by the U.S. State Department and other agencies to partner with countries in Africa, in South America, and others to try to come up with a more stable and robust supply chain, because we certainly do need it if the market is trending in the way that the policymakers believe, which is the transition to more electric vehicles, to more renewable energy. That's going to take a lot more critical minerals than we currently have or would have without government intervention.
So I was watching a Sky News documentary on Chile last night and sort of their lithium industry. And also they have the world's deepest copper mine. It's over 1 kilometer deep. And the lithium, I mean, the extraction process and everything, it actually seems quite environmentally damaging. You know, they basically just let this stuff just sit and evaporate out in these enormous rows and then sort of harvest it. But it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I know you said there's no silver bullet, Kellyanne, but you did mention sort of recycling. I'm curious, how viable is that? You know, again, it's probably not a silver bullet, but particularly if we're talking about environmental harm and in terms of mining and its extraction, just how far could you get with recycling materials, you know, within the U.S. to go, okay, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know how viable this is, right? But let's say to get lithium out of something, or, you know, or has been used up, right? I mean, I can imagine extracting nickel and other things, but how viable is a recycling approach, and how much does that really solve? That's not the only solution, but, and it sounds like that's things some government agencies have explored, but how far has that gone?
Yeah, I recently read that the largest source of all critical minerals is in everyone's junk drawer. It's that iPhone, it's that laptop, it's, you know, that electronics that you just have left there and haven't actually recycled for use of the critical minerals. And, you know, recycling is a huge opportunity. And I should say, not every critical mineral can be recycled in a manner in which it can be used in the same way that it was put in. There may be, depending on the mineral and the product, some degradation of that mineral, but most of them can be, right? Most of the mineral can be salvaged, but it takes processes to do so. It takes consumers knowing about it, knowing that they should partner with whoever in the community, whether that's an electronics store or a local effort, is willing to pick up those old cell phones, those old laptops, and take them somewhere for that type of processing. But that's certainly something that will, and we would hope, grow over the next few years, because it's a tremendous source, as opposed to having to figure out how do we dig this out of the ground, process it, get it to where it needs to go. Why don't we just recycle what's already been used out there? And Tim, I should say, I think I watched the same documentary or the same Sky News piece, because I remember seeing that huge hole that was burying that poor city.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Anyway, I think, you know, with that, we have a lot to contemplate, you know, as we go forward. And Kellyanne, do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, this is a really important issue. It has been plaguing policymakers for the last 15 years. You know, in the Obama administration, brought two WTO cases against China for critical minerals and rare earths, because China in 2010 said that it was going to restrict exports by 40%. And, you know, China lost that case at the WTO. It took several years to litigate. But nevertheless, we're still in the same predicament we were when we started. So I think one thing that is pretty clear is that, you know, taking China or other countries to the WTO is not a solution. We need a lot of different solutions to this problem. And as technology evolves, as our concept of critical minerals evolve, we're certainly going to need to leverage not just the government, but the private sector and consumers in trying to get everybody on the same page that this is now the fundamental building blocks to a modern economy. So we've got to figure this out.
Excellent wrap up. So thank you again for joining us, Kellyanne. I think we're probably going to have other questions on future episodes, or we're going to want to bring you in to talk about all the pieces that you mentioned here. I mean, everything from what our allies are doing and how the U.S. is working with them to even just talk about batteries, right, and renewable energy. So thanks again for joining the show, and we'll see everybody next time.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.